The following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
I want us to continue this afternoon with our study of what it is to speak the truth in love. That is to say, how we address one another, how we approach Christian communications. Is it necessary for us to speak the truth? By all means. We truth one another. Many times, however, in the name of various things, I think it all boils down ultimately to manipulation, but in the name of various things, we tell something other than the truth. Well, does that mean that we're always telling a lie? Well, it doesn't mean that we're necessarily telling a lie, but if we're not being straightforward, if we're not being forthright in our communications, then I submit to you that we're not really meeting the requirements of speaking the truth. At the same time, we must do it out of a motivation for God's glory and for our good. That is to say, we must love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and our neighbors as ourselves. That has to be the motivation for our speech. And if our motivation is something other than that, then we also are not speaking the truth in love. We've looked at several general ideas having to do with communication, general communications guidelines. And what I want us to do this afternoon is to descend a little bit more to particulars. We spoke last time we were together about the tension level of a conversation, that many times tension levels are increased or are decreased by either the things that we say or the way in which we say them. And as I was speaking, it was pointed out to me later that I was speaking in a thunderstorm, and it's not because I didn't deserve to be struck. But the fact that I wasn't struck indicates to me that perhaps I have some important things to say not only to you but to me as well. How do we raise the tension level in a conversation? Do you all know what I mean by tension level? Have you ever noticed that sometimes, you don't know what that means? Have you ever noticed that sometimes a conversation just is not a matter of information being conveyed back and forth, but emotions become the center of the conversation rather than the content of the statements being made or the questions being asked and so forth? And there are ways that we can raise the tension level. We looked at a couple last week. Tone, for example, can raise the tension level. Sarcasm, anger, disrespect, all of those things can raise the tension level of a conversation. If we say something, whether intentionally or unintentionally, that raises the tension level of a conversation, that provokes someone else to resentment or to anger, then is it the case that we're speaking the truth in love? Let me suggest to you that it may very well not be. It may very well be the case, and is usually the case. In fact, I would have to really examine what the exception would be, where if we're using provocative language, we're not raising the tension level in an undesirable way. So I want to give us just some examples. This is hardly meant to be an exhaustive list. These are simply some examples of the kind of provocative language that we sometimes use, whether intentionally or whether unintentionally. But because we don't want simply to instruct and rebuke and reprove, we want also to correct, I'm going to suggest to you some other language that might be used in place of the provocative language. Okay? Speaking to some of you businessmen right now, if you have to deal with the public in any way. For example, if you're in retail sales or If you've ever had a situation where you work behind a counter and you have customer relations that you have to deal with, people come back, and sometimes it happens that people come back to a retailer with a product and they say, well, you know, this doesn't really work right, but I don't care because all I wanted to do was spend money with you anyway. But that doesn't happen very often. Most of the time when they come back with a product, there is a certain level of ire involved. Do you know what ire is? Yeah, they're upset, aren't they? They're fretting. Maybe they're pounding your desk or the counter or whatever it might be. Let me share something with you that if I didn't tell you, you may never find out. But I have found this out after working with retail customers, many times angry, irate customers. Sometimes the customer is irate for good cause, sometimes not for good cause. Sometimes he's mad just because he's got kind of person. Sometimes he's mad because he bought something expecting it to work and it didn't do what he expected it to do. But we've got a situation now where we have an irate customer. Okay? I'm using this example not because I think all of you are in business, because all of you have to deal with retail customers, but I'm giving you from my background, from my experience, what I have found works. It manages to defuse situations. And if we go into a situation knowing what to expect, see, an awful lot of times the reason that we get upset with a situation is because it didn't go according to the script we had written. Right? We were expecting one thing out of a conversation and something else happened. Right? So let me tell you what's going to happen when you have a situation already loaded. Okay, I'm going to load the gun. The customer is coming in and he's already mad. There's nothing that you've done to raise the level of the tension in the conversation. He came in loaded for bear. Three things he's going to do. Are you ready? Got your pencils out? He's going to give you a specific complaint. Listen for it. Listen for the specific complaint. Second, he's going to give you an exaggerated complaint or a general complaint. Those will usually be two different things. Listen for it, because he has to get it out. Okay? If he doesn't get it out, the conversation can't progress. He's just going to keep on interrupting you until he gets it out. So listen for it. Make sure he gets it out. And then the third thing he's going to do is make a threat. Now we'll talk about what kind of threat it is in just a moment. But write down threat. He's going to threaten you. Now, how many of you actually either are now or have been in retail or customer relations or you've worked behind a counter? Okay? Let me give you the three things in order, and you stop and think about every dissatisfied customer you've ever had, and you tell me if I'm speaking his language. I just bought this thing from you, and it didn't work. What was that? That was a specific complaint. I just bought this thing from you. Actually, that isn't the way he'll say it. If he's happy with it, he just bought it from you. If he's unhappy with it, you just sold it to him. That's the way it goes. That's the way it is. This thing you just sold me doesn't work. Okay, there's a specific complaint, right? Then you're going to get a general complaint. It will usually involve you, but not always. The general complaint may be something along the lines of, "Nothing you ever sell me ever works." An exaggerated complaint. Everything you sell here is a piece of junk. I never get my money's worth these days. The whole country's going downhill. It's our educational system. There's going to be an exaggerated complaint. Listen for it. He has to get it out of his system. Then there's going to be a threat. And if you don't do something about it, I'm never shopping here again. Maybe some of you have said that. I don't know. Maybe that's the approach that y'all have taken. I can't say with certainty, but that's an irate customer. An irate customer, a person who feels as though he didn't get his money worth, has to get those three things out of his system. Now, if we're going to deal with a situation that's already loaded, that's already explosive, we're going to have to just sit there and take it. Now, you'll do it for money. Will you do it for love? How many of you, your boss would give you a raise if you just started screaming back at that irate customer? How many of you think your boss would just give you a raise, pat you on the back, probably promote you to head of the department? None of you? Because your boss knows that if you were to respond in that way, what would happen? He'd lose the customer. And he's not there to make you feel good about yourself. He's there to make money. Am I right? You'd probably lose your job if you treated very many customers in the way that I just suggested, elevating the tension level or even maintaining the tension level. So your job at that point as Mr. Customer Relations or Ms. Customer Relations, your job at that point is to reduce the tension level, isn't it? Now, how many of you have ever worked in customer relations or behind a counter or in sales or had to deal with irate customers before? Okay. Did you ever have to reduce the tension level of a conversation like I just described? Okay. When I talk about tension from now on, think about your irate customer. That's what we're talking about when we talk about tension levels. We're talking about things that have become unreasonable, emotionally laden, perhaps even threatening. Okay? Does that help? By the way, how do you deal with that customer? How do you deal with that irate customer? Well, let me tell you how I think you deal with that irate customer. Maybe one of you will hire me to be your customer relations person. The way I think you deal with it is you make sure that that person has all three of those things out of their system, out of his system, out of her system. You make sure that they got it all out. Because anything that you say before they get everything out, anything you say, if you tell them how pretty they are, before they get those three things out, as far as they're concerned, you've interrupted them. So, you listen very carefully. And if they don't get all three out, you ask this question. Is there anything else? Go for it. Get it out of their system. Purge it. Is there anything else? And then, when they've got all of that out of their system, here's what you say. We certainly seem to have a problem here, don't we? What should we do about it? What just happened? You just jumped over the counter and took their side, didn't you? We certainly seem to have a problem here, don't we? What would you suggest we do about it? And no matter how he takes it, no matter how the customer takes it, well, he's going to take it one of two ways. Either he's going to take it from the standpoint of, you're on his side now, and that's what you mean by we, or that you're accepting responsibility, and that's what you mean by we. And that's okay. One of the things that we're going to learn, hopefully this afternoon and in our next session, is how to take 100% responsibility of a conversation. Not 100% control, but 100% responsibility for a conversation. Now, think that might work? Now, you wouldn't exaggerate the we's the way I just did. I was exaggerating that so that you would remember which were the important words. You would say something like, well, we certainly have a serious problem here, don't we? Well, yeah, he just told you we did. We certainly have a serious problem here, don't we? What would you suggest we do about it? And if he's looking, if he's looking for any kind of a reasonable satisfaction, he'll suggest something to you. And at that point, you become the negotiator, right? You know what you're able to do. Now he's told you what he wants you to do. Now it becomes negotiation. Before it was confrontation, right? Now what is it? Now it's negotiation. What have you done? Have you raised or lowered the tension level of the conversation? You've lowered the tension level of the conversation because you took responsibility for the conversation. Now, I'm going to give you some examples of provocative language. For example, here would be a provocative answer to the customer that just came in and said, "That thing you sold me doesn't work. Nothing I ever buy from you ever works, and I'm never going to buy anything from you ever again if you don't make this right." And you say, "Well, it works for everybody else. I wonder what you're doing wrong." Now, maybe the guy is doing something wrong. Maybe he hasn't got a clue as to how it was supposed to work. Maybe he's got it installed upside down. Who knows what? Okay? But by answering him in that way, did you raise or lower the tension level in the conversation? You raised it. And that's the last thing your boss wants you to do, isn't it? He doesn't want you raising tension levels. He wants you lowering them. So, provocative language. What we're going to do then is we're going to look at some examples. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 examples, maybe 10 examples of provocative language that we use every day. And we're going to learn some proper language to use instead of that. Okay? Ready? Provocative. You don't care. And it may take another form. You don't care about me. You don't care about your job. You don't care about the children. You don't care about the house. See the different forms that can take? But the provocative language is what? It's an accusation, isn't it? It's an accusation. You don't care. Let me suggest to you that what the person really intends to say is, "You don't care about me." Why is that important? Why is it important that you don't care about me? Because I need you. Because I love you. Because I want you. That's why it's important that you don't care about me. So let's just cut to the chase. The language that we use instead of the provocative you don't care is, "I need you. I love you. I want you." How many of you feel like it's really provoking to have somebody tell you how much they love you? How many of you think it might be provoking to be told you don't care about them? Does it accomplish the same thing? I think it accomplishes more. I think it accomplishes saying what we really intend to say. The truth is, we need the other person, or we wouldn't consider that whether they cared or not to be important. If I were to say to you that my letter carrier here in Rowlett doesn't love you, how many of you does that make a big difference to you? No. Well, yeah, as long as he delivers the mail, you know, the only one he really has to love is me, right? But if it were someone who was supposed to be close to you, if it were your wife or your husband, if it were your children, if it were your boss, something like that, then you would consider that to be an important bit of information, that they don't love you or they don't care. So what we really mean to say is, "I need you. I love you. I care about you." Be careful that you don't say, "I care about you more than you care about me." That's, now you're right back to provocative language again, right? Okay. What was number one? What was number one?
You don't care.
Okay. Yes, I do. I wouldn't have asked if I didn't care. All right. Number two. What complaints do you have? Now what do you have to complain about? Yeah. Now what's the matter? Do all those sound provocative enough? What might be a tension reducing way of asking the same information? What information are we asking for? Yeah, we're asking, "Why are you so mad?" Right? Right? Or why are you so upset? Is that what we're asking? Is it? When we ask a question like, "What Why are you complaining? What's your beef? You know, what is that what we're asking? I'd like an agreement from you before we go on. Is that what we're asking? How's this? It sounds like you've had a hard day. How can I help? How can I be of help? What can I do? Are you tired? Can I help? Ladies and gentlemen, husbands and wives, let me tell you, this may not be a cure-all. This may not cure every last problem you'll ever have in your marriage, but it sure will help. Keep some baby oil around the house and rub each other's feet. Oh, I know you're saying to yourself, how can that possibly be as important as he says it is? I'll tell you why, is because I have found it is impossible to be mad at somebody who's rubbing your feet. I know what some of you are thinking, but listen, it's worth it. Your marriages are worth saving. And believe me, this is something that if we would do it more for one another. Do you remember what happened on the night before Jesus was betrayed? What did he do? Yeah, he rubbed their feet, didn't he? He washed them, right? He washed their feet. He took upon himself the role of a servant. He girded himself about like a servant, didn't he? So, how can we help one another? When we've had a hard day, probably none of you men who are sitting here come home from the office at the end of the day irritable. But people that are watching the tape probably do. So this is for them, you understand. Men, how much would it help? Would you love to have your feet rubbed at the end of the day? Well, yeah. Yeah, for the purposes of the tape, that was a single guy. Well, now listen, don't you suppose your wife would love it just as much as you do? Don't you think? Yeah, she has a hard day too. I'm perfectly serious. I can't tell you how many marriages I believe that would save. You shouldn't feel that way. You shouldn't feel that way. That's number three. You shouldn't feel that way. What do we mean to say? Well, we probably mean to say something to the effect of, I disapprove of you, of your opinions. Right? But would that raise or lower the tension level? It would raise it. So how do we say the same thing while at the same time lowering the tension level? I'm sorry you feel that way. How can I help? Now, I'm not talking about by the tone of our voice with sarcasm or with condescension, saying essentially the same thing with different words. I'm talking about lowering the tension level by honestly trying to be of help. And you know what? As you begin making that offer and following through on that offer of help, you'll gain credibility. When you ask, how can I help, people will begin to believe you. And again, this is just as true at the office as it is at home. How can I help works. People are always willing to give you things to do. Have you noticed that? How can I help? People are always willing to give you things to do. Now, that doesn't mean that just because they suggest something that you're going to do it. But what you've done is you've lowered the tension level in the conversation, haven't you? Just because they've said something to you, just when you say, how can I help? And they say, well, go take a flying leap off a bridge. That doesn't mean you're going to do it, right? But you've lowered the tension level somewhat in the conversation by offering to help rather than by censuring their feelings. When did you censure their feelings? When you told them that they shouldn't feel that way. Or you shouldn't think that way. I'm sorry. You feel that way. How can I help? Why do we tell them? Because we're censuring their feelings. We don't think that their feelings are correct.
No, I'm saying how do we?
Oh, how do we? By saying that we're sorry that they feel that way. Yes, yes, yes. Usually provocative language, usually, I'm not going to say 100% of the time, never say always, but ordinarily, the reason that we use provocative language, the reason that we raise the tension level, even if it's not our desire to raise the tension level, is so that we can control the conversation. And what I'm suggesting to you is rather than attempting to control the conversation, we take responsibility for the conversation. There's a difference. In other words, if we have it as our objective, I'm going to lower the tension level, and if the tension level's not lowered, it's 100% my fault. That's taking responsibility for it. If I'm going to get the upper hand no matter what happens in the conversation, that's controlling or attempting to control the conversation. We're going to talk about various ways that we attempt to manipulate conversations in a little bit. You never do such and such, or you always do such and such. That's that exaggeration that we spoke about earlier. Is it the case that anybody always does anything? That's just sheer exaggeration, isn't it? What's the purpose for our exaggerating? Why do we exaggerate like that? Well, it's to emphasize or to magnify our case and minimize their case. How about, it would certainly be helpful to me if you would do such and such less. You always bring the car back without any gas in it. Okay, that's just an example. Or you always squeeze the toothpaste tube in the middle. Whatever it happens to be. Okay, you always do such and such. It would certainly be helpful to me if you'd buy two tubes of toothpaste. Right? Then you can squeeze yours in the middle as much as you want. It would certainly be helpful to me if you'd bring the car back gassed up. Which is more provocative and which is less provocative? The information that we're trying to convey is that we want the car brought back gassed up, right? The information that we're trying to convey is that we don't like using a toothpaste tube that's been squeezed in the middle. I guess that's what we're trying to do. If that's our intention. Now, if that's not our intention, if our intention is just to control a conversation, then again, we need to back away from that entirely and take responsibility for the conversation and take 100% responsibility to lower the tension level. But if it's our intention to, if we have an honest intention to try to get the car gassed up, then it would certainly be helpful to me if you'd bring the car back full of gas rather than you always bring it back empty. One's an accusation, isn't it? The other is an appeal for help. You finally got around to cooking dinner on time. I'm glad to see you finally got around to fill in the blank. How about, I really appreciated how dinner was on the table when I walked in the door. You must really love me to do that. Hey guys, do we ever take our wives for granted? Not us. I mean the guys on the tape. Do they ever take their wives for granted? Sometimes they do, don't they? And truth be known, sometimes we do as well. What I'm suggesting to you is that when we use things like you finally got around to, or I'm glad to see you finally did such and such, all we're doing is belittling. Do you understand that? Wives, I know you never do that either, but and you might just put it in your notes in case you finally meet a wife someday that does do that. Here's one that I have to stop myself probably once every conversation. I just put on the brakes because I do this a lot. What you're really saying is, Fill in the blank. What am I doing there? I'm putting words in other people's mouths, aren't I? How about this? Could you explain that another way? I don't think I quite understand yet. If I'm asking for more information, if it's not my objective just to put words in their mouth, then could you explain that another way? I still don't quite understand. Or, if the tension level is already fairly low, the tension level is not particularly at a fever pitch, you might say something like, well, do I understand you correctly to be saying? You're giving the person the opportunity to say, no, that's not at all what I intended. Here's one that I find particularly well. We're going to talk about a particular conversation style that we will eventually call angering. But here's just an example of it. Now you're just getting mad. You're just getting angry. You're just getting mad. Why is that provocative? It's accusing, but it's also changing the subject, isn't it? How about this? We're going to take 100% responsibility for our conversation now, right? This conversation, whose responsibility is it? It's mine, right? So if the tension level is going to go down, who's going to have to bring it down? I am. Did I say something provocative? Now, whose fault was it the first time? You're just getting angry. You're just getting mad. Whose fault was that? Who was I expecting to take responsibility for the conversation? The other person. Did I say something provocative? Now who's taking responsibility for the conversation? I am. You see the difference? And if the other person is getting angry, the chances are pretty high that I did say something provocative. Either that or I'm just making an excuse for changing the subject to them instead of me. Yeah, you're just like, you're similar to, well, what you're saying is just like, fill in the blank, you know, whatever. The Nazis. Is what anybody is saying just like something else? No. And if we disagree with it, then the honest thing to say is, well, I disagree with what you're saying. Right? Not, well, what you're saying is just like the Nazis. Right? But another way of lowering the tension level is I don't think I completely understand what it is you want. Right? Now, could you rephrase that, please, if it doesn't become, again, we need to be careful if we ask someone to rephrase something that we don't give the impression, well, the way you phrased it before was so stupid, nobody could understand it. Yeah. But you know, if I'm going to take responsibility for it, I don't think I completely understood. Right? Instead of, you didn't make that clear. And again, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that could be a legitimate request for information. But we're going to take responsibility now for the conversation, so we're going to admit, I'm not sure I completely understood you. Because what did you mean by that could, again, in a high tension, in a high context conversation, in a high tension level conversation, what did you mean by that could be understood as what? Well, yeah, where's the innuendo? You're not being straightforward, right? I'm sorry? Hidden motives, hidden meanings, hidden agenda.
Right.
Right, all those things. We're still in particulars. How many of you have found yourself, you're involved in a conversation, and you know and I know that we think faster than we speak? How many of you have found yourself in the middle of a conversation and all of a sudden you tuned back into the conversation and you weren't sure exactly where it was? What? Uh-oh. I lost track. How many of you has that ever happened to you? Now, that's the easy one. Let me ask you the hard one now. You don't have to answer this. But how many of you have gotten lost because you weren't attending to what the other person was saying because you were trying to figure out what you were going to say next? Yeah, that happens a lot too. Blocks to attending. By attending, I mean more than just hearing. I mean actually, shall we say, paying attention to. Do we use that? You all know that cliche or that phrase, to pay attention to someone? Yeah, attending. Blocks. Ways that we keep from attending to a conversation. These are all R's. You're going to love this. Are you ready? Ruling out the speaker. How do we do that? What's our attitude when we rule someone out? He's got nothing to say to me. It's not his place. If he had been where I was, and so on. Ruling out. We just, before we ever hear it, we just rule him out of court. Number two, reaching a premature conclusion. I say reaching, I really mean jumping, don't I? Jumping to a conclusion. Reaching a premature conclusion has the R in it. Reaching a premature conclusion. I've heard all this before. I know what he's going to say. Or as we say in my house, yada, yada, yada. I've heard all this before. Reading in expectations. I know what you're going to say next. This is a symptom of I've heard all this before, right? Reading in expectations. I know what you're going to say. So why should I listen? Just like that customer. It's real easy when that irate customer comes in to say, yeah, I know what you're going to say. You're going to have a specific threat. You're going to have a specific complaint. You're going to have a general complaint. You're going to have a threat. I know that. But that's why I warned you, even knowing that, listen for them. Make sure you hear them. Attend to them. Reading in expectations. Four, reading out threats. Can you see my face? Can you see my eyes? Can you see my eyes? Okay, watch me read out a threat. Isn't nonverbal communication great? I can't believe you said that! Nobody believes that. Reading out. Reading in expectations, reading out threats. Racing ahead. Are we at number five? Racing ahead. Boy, my mind is a mile away. You know, I was just thinking about Vidalia onions. Yeah. My mind's a mile away. I just raced way ahead. You know, because we can think faster than we can talk, and we can think faster than we can listen. So our mind has a tendency to get ahead of the conversation. First thing you know, we're off on 14 different rabbit trails. So maybe that's an R synonym for racing ahead is rabbit trails. Okay, number six, rehearsing. Rehearsing, that's the one that I think we use probably the most. I know what I'm going to say next. Here's what I'm going to say next. What I'm going to say next is, you know, revising the script. Reacting. Number seven. Reacting. How do we react? Well, there are certain trigger words. And listen, I'm going to speak especially now to you men and wives, husbands and wives, And the reason is not because I'm coming down on you in particular, but because husbands and wives live so close to one another in such a high context environment that we know exactly what it takes to set the other person off, don't we? Now, don't we? Of course we do. And sometimes, sin being what it is, and all of us here being sinners, sometimes we just lean on that button as hard as we can lean, don't we? Some of you are looking at me like I must be talking about some other church. No, I know we all do that, and hopefully what's going through your minds right now is, I hope I don't do that again. Number 8, responding but with evaluation. I don't know what else to call that but responding. It's not really responding. Responding, I want to say that responding is more a realistic answer to what somebody has said. But when I say responding with evaluation, what I mean by that is that the evaluation is that what you're saying is not as important as the way you're saying it. What's another R word for that? It's not really reacting. Reacting is hearing certain trigger words and then responding to those trigger words, hearing certain things that set you off and then being set off by them. But responding, instead of responding with a realistic answer to what the person has said, you respond with an evaluation of the way they said it. Reformulation, maybe, but it's something like this. Well, you're saying that because of such and such, or in the old Westerns, smile when you say that, partner. Rephrasing, okay, something like that, where what you're doing is you're responding to the person's supposed motivations or supposed mannerisms rather than responding to what they said, to what he or she said. Right? If I were to say to somebody, you have gravy on your tie, and they were to respond to me, I don't like the way you say gravy, you mean juice. In other words, we're not dealing now with what the person said. We're finding fault with the way it was said or with the way it was formulated. And then rejection is really just the previous one, the responding or reformulation. Rejection is that carried to the fullest degree. You come on too strong. I wouldn't mind you telling me that I have gravy on my tie if you just wouldn't say it that way. You just come on too strong. Or it's just your personality to go around finding fault. Right? What did I do? I changed the subject from gravy and ties to what? To the other person's manner. So really numbers 8 and 9 are the same thing. It's just that one is a degree worse than the other. I have a list here of 6 kinds of questions that are not really questions. First of all, let's formulate this. What is a real question? A real question should be formulated so as to ask for information, right? If a question is designed to do something other than ask for information, then it's manipulative. And the objective has become one not of gaining information, but of controlling the conversation. Okay. Do we have time for 6 of them? Okay. Number 1, the leading question. What's a leading question? Can anybody give me an example of a leading question? Don't you feel the Republicans should win? Or wouldn't you rather use Downey? What does that do? It limits or restricts our range of choices. Wouldn't you rather use Downy? What does that do? It limits or restricts our range of choices. The objective is not to retrieve information from the person. The objective becomes to teach them or to lead their thinking toward a particular thing. Salesmen do this a lot, don't they? I mean, no offense, but salesmen do this a lot. And the reason they do it is because they're looking for a particular answer. Yes, I want to drive a Buick. Or yes, I want to watch a Zenith. Or the salesman is looking for an answer like that, isn't he? Right? So that's why he leads rather than asking. There are some questions you don't have to ask. If you're working in a television store and somebody walks in, you probably don't have to ask, why are you here? Right? Or if you work, you know, he says, well, I was looking for where they sell cars, but I guess I'm in the wrong place. Right? There are some questions we just don't have to ask. And the leading question is intended to do what? Is it intended to elicit information, or is it intended to direct a conversation? It's intended to direct a conversation, control a conversation, or manipulate a conversation. The punishing question. We talked about this a little bit. We parents use this with our children a lot, don't we? Why'd you say? Why'd you do? Why'd you try that? Why'd you spill that milk? Was the example that I've used before. Well, why'd you try that? Why'd you come in here? What does it try to do? Well, first of all, it's provocative because there's not a satisfying answer. You know, I've disapproved of your action. Now I'm asking the question not to find out why you did what I disapproved of, but in order to punish you for doing what I disapproved of. That's why it's a punishing question. So it's provocative, and what it's doing is it's trying to arouse conflicts in the other party. It's trying to arouse some conflict. Oh no, I can't answer this. I must be wrong, stupid, dumb, clumsy, whatever. Okay? There's some conflict going on in me now. So what's happened is the very asking of the question has brought about what? Punishment. The demanding question. When you write it down, it takes the form of a question, but when you listen carefully, it's really a command. When are you going to do something about that? I hope those proofs are going to be ready by Tuesday. Or what it does is it sneaks in a command, doesn't it? Under the guise of a question. You see that? How many of you have never used that before? So have I. The demanding question. The hypothetical question. These are questions that start off with what if, or what would you do if, or how about if this happened. What's wrong with a hypothetical question? Well, this. It calls for a hypothetical answer, and it typically sets up an unrealistic situation. Hypothetical questions are typically used to set up unrealistic situations. Now, when we make decisions, we usually make decisions based on the best information that's available to us at the time that we make the decision. But a hypothetical situation seldom has the kind of information that we need to make a decision. Here's how you can tell if that's being used. When you answer the question, another hypothetical is set up right behind it. Nobody is allowed two hypotheticals in a row. What that means is, I'm looking for you to fail. And you didn't fail the first time, so now we're going to set it up differently. We're going to make it more extreme. We're going to make it less realistic so that this time you'll fail. The purpose of a hypothetical question is to get you to fail. Why? Well, because very few things in life are knee-jerk situations. The needling question. What are you waiting for? We've snuck a command in there too, haven't we? How did we sneak the command in when we asked, what are you waiting for? Yeah, hurry up! Right? This question can be asked at so many levels. This is a multi-level question. You all know what multi-level questions are. No matter what level I answer, the other person comes back and says, oh, you answered it wrong. Or that he didn't understand the real question. Oh, well, you didn't understand my real question. My real question was, and then he asks another multi-level question. The needling question, what are you waiting for? And then finally, the setup question. Now, the setup question assumes that there are two identical situations, one that took place before now and the one that we're dealing with now. Well, didn't you once say that such and such? It assumes or posits an identity of situation, and the identity of situation is highly unlikely. It's just very unlikely that two situations in your life are ever going to be identical. And it's an attempt, isn't it, to use someone's words against him. Say, well, didn't you once say that? And now as soon as I quote the other person, didn't you once say that? Do you suppose that that's going to confirm what he's saying, or do you suppose it's going to contradict what he's saying? Well, usually when I use that setup question, what am I doing? I'm trying to use his words to contradict him. What a fool you are to think that you can contradict yourself in front of me. And so the setup question, it's particularly, all of these questions that we've talked about are what we call complex questions in logic. What's a complex question? Complex question is something that asks more than one thing at the same time. Or it asks so many things that it's impossible to tell what's being asked. The false dilemma is the example that's usually used in the textbooks of a complex question. Have you stopped beating your wife? Yes or no? Well, if you say yes, then what are you admitting to? Having previously beaten your wife, right? If you say no, then what are you admitting to? No, I haven't quit yet. See, it's a complex question. It's a question that doesn't have a realistic answer. Well, all these are complex questions that we've just talked about. We need to remove them from our vocabulary. They're provocative. They foist off the responsibility for the conversation on the other person. And that's not the way we're going to do anymore, right? We're going to take 100% responsibility for all of our conversations. And if the tension level gets out of hand, whose fault is it? It's mine. And what we need to do, you know, sometimes when we've just had a conversation where the tension level got out of hand, is our immediate reaction to go back and, what did I do wrong? How could I have lowered the tension level? Or is our natural reaction more along the lines of, well, that dummy, if he hadn't been that way, we could have, yeah, our usual reaction is to blame the other person, to see everything that was provocative in his conduct and nothing that was provocative in our own, right? Isn't that the usual way? Well, what we need to learn, we need to get rid of that behavior